My name is Bill Grace, and I'm from the Center for Ethical Leadership. This session is entitled Democracy and Christianity. And how many people were in a room, might have been last week, where I talked about gracious space? Does that ring a bell? Okay, so just a quick background, 2 seconds. There's a theologian and an educator whose name is Parker Palmer. And excuse me here, this is embarrassing, but I'll feel better. He says that two rules automatically fall into place when we try to create a community. Does this ring a bell for anybody? Okay, good. Because I'm glad you didn't have to hear it twice. He said, two rules automatically fall into place when we try to start a community. Number one is the last person in the world that you'd like to show up shows up. And that the second rule of community is that as soon as you manage to get that person to leave, somebody else comes to take his or her place. So that community for Parker Palmer is about constantly inviting the stranger. And so how do we create space where the stranger feels welcome? And at the center where I work, we call that space gracious space. And I give you that background because one of the things that we believe now at the center, and we're trying to live this out, is that one of the things that's allowed in gracious space is half-baked ideas. You know, you've been in meetings and somebody's like, well, that's a half-baked idea. And, you know, the idea is, you know, go home and think about it, sort of perfect the idea, and then tell us. Well, at the center, we welcome half-baked ideas, and what we do is we promise to help the person bake the other half of the loaf. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so it's a different sort of space. And so what I'd like to do this morning is to present a half-baked idea, and I'd like you to hold it with me and help me to bake the other half of the loaf. Okay, so because essentially I have a couple hunches, and I've not researched it. I've really hardly done any study at all. Maybe an hour. It's really just a hunch that I have. But I would like to explore it with you and see what we can do together to see if it makes sense. You will be helpful to me if you tell me that this idea makes no sense at all, or if it makes some sense. All of that will be helpful feedback. So here are the two hunches that I have. Is that Christianity gives birth to democracy over time. Okay? And that the second hunch is that the authentic church, we can come back and talk about that word if it's important, the word authentic. The authentic church can only continue to mature and develop through the practice and principles of authentic democracy. Does that make sense? We may differ with that, but I want to see if you understand the two hunches. That Christianity gives birth to democracy, and that the church's maturity and ongoing development will be dependent upon practicing the principles of democracy. That it'll be difficult for the church to continue to mature in any other setting other than a democratic one. And so, for those of you who have Bibles, I'm going to use a little bit of scripture and a little bit of this book by Dan Erlander, Manna and Mercy, to see if we can't put some sort of scriptural experience and lay aside these hunches that I have. So would someone turn to Luke, chapter 4, verses 16 through 19. And as you read this, what I'd like you to think about is what is happening to the question of power as these words are read. Has anybody found it? Luke 4, verses 16 through 19. Would someone like to read that? Okay, thanks, Mary.
When he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, He went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim a year of favor of the Lord."
Okay, let's just hang on to that image. This is Jesus' first sermon, if you will, his first teaching. And he begins to suggest that maybe some power shifts are in order. Let's take a look at, are you all familiar with this book?
I've seen it in the library.
Manna and Mercy by Dan Erlander. It's he got a lot of the ideas for this while he was up in Holden Village. It's a look at the Old and New Testament and paraphrasing different parts of the Bible, and with some wonderful pictures and cartoons, especially two little gophers who kind of observe the whole scene and have these incredible sidebar comments as God is doing God's redeeming work. In chapter 2, he talks about the birth of God's people, and that happens in Egypt. And I'm going to ask someone to read it, but what I'd like you to see is to take a look at the pyramid here. Mm-hmm. Pharaoh's on top, and at the bottom, slaves, 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 slaves. Okay? It's a delightful book, and I think also very, very wise. I went too fast. I'll pass it around. But I would like someone to read these two paragraphs in the right-hand column. Who would like to try to read that?
I can try.
Okay, here.
It's probably more light over there.
Okay, let me get you some light.
Which, these two paragraphs?
The ones in the right-hand column.
Once upon a time, God was vexed with a nation called Egypt. In this nation, a big deal Pharaoh was on top. In the middle were various big deals and ordinary citizens. On the bottom were the slaves who lived under heavy oppression, Exodus 1:8 through 14. The slaves were descendants of early believers in God, Abraham, Sarah, Rebecca, Isaac, Leah, Rachel, and Jacob, Genesis 11:26 through 37, verse 1. It was Sarah and Abraham who received the promise that their offspring would bless all nations, Genesis 12:1 through 5. Because of the slave labor, the big deals of Egypt lived in ease and luxury. The Pharaoh, who thought he owned everything, Genesis 47, depended upon the priests and the military to keep the whole system going and to maintain the status quo. Everyone, including the slaves, considered Egypt to be eternal. God detested this system. Exodus 1, 1 through 3, verse 8.
So again, just another image of what Jesus might have been speaking to, although this is prior to Jesus' time. Let's just take a look at one more image in the Manna and Mercy book. And I will both show you quickly, but I'm going to pass it around. You'll be able to look at both pages 4 and 22. Now the people of Israel left Pharaoh's Egypt and went to what Erlander calls, I love this, wilderness school. He says they were in the wilderness for 40 years because they, you know, essentially had to unlearn everything they knew in Pharaoh's Egypt, and they needed to learn how to be God's people, what Erlander calls God's contrast society. But they have made it to the land of milk and honey, and they have forgot about the Sabbath principles of sharing wealth and caring more about community than property. So what I'd like you to take a look at in this case is to look at what they've established, the land of milk and honey, mm-hmm. and see if that shape rings a bell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they have left Pharaoh's Egypt, they went to wilderness school, they were rescued by God on a number of occasions. God taught them how they could be a different people, and must be human nature. Once again, they created a hierarchy. I need someone to read one more little paragraph. Who would like to read?
I would.
Okay. Your turn. Okay. You're going to read this here, including the big print at the bottom.
God's hope did not work out. When Solomon succeeded David, the worst fears of the anti-king people came through. Turning from the manor way, Solomon and his elites gathered massive wealth for themselves. They imposed forced labor and heavy taxes, and God's partner people became a society of big deals and little deals, exploiters and exploited, forsaken both righteousness and mercy. Solomon found glory in his 700 wives and 300 concubines, his palace, his army, his piles of gold, silver, ivory, cedar, and fine clothes, and in his collection of apes and baboons. 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 14 to chapter 11, verse 13. Yahweh wept, and all creation wept, because Israel had become what Israel had left, Pharaoh's Egypt.
Okay. And it's against that backdrop, Israel had become what Israel had left, Pharaoh's Egypt. It's against that backdrop that Jesus stands up and proclaims something new once again. Let us just read one more. In this case, let's just get one more volunteer. In this case, we'll be reading from this maroon book again. And if you have the maroon book, Luke chapter 22, verses 24 through 28. Who would like to read that? It's the trouble with being a small group. At this point in the village, it's like, yeah, thanks.
A dispute also arose among them as to which one of them was to be regarded as the greatest. But Jesus said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors, but not so with you. Rather, the greatest among you must become like the youngest, and the leader like one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table, or the one who serves? Is it not the one at the table? But I am among you as one who serves."
One of the lines I'd like you to really hear there is, "But not so with you." My sense is that that is a call to a new way of understanding the distribution of power. At one level, it is this. It is servant leadership. I ordered a number of these. There's only two left in the village, counting this one. If you're not familiar with this book and interested in the concepts of leadership, I encourage you to pick it up. By Robert Greenleaf, I believe written in 1978. There's probably been 100 books written on leadership since it, and I happen to believe, in my opinion, that it's still probably one of the best books on leadership ever written. So I encourage you to look at this if leadership is an interest of yours. And Greenleaf picks up on a lot of the concepts we've been talking about, but does so in a very practical way. I'm going to float this book around like I promised, and if you will remember, and I'll try to mark it with something here. Can I won't need these notes anymore, so I'll be okay. Page 4, page 22, and then at the very end, I'd like you to take a look at 93. And essentially what you're going to be seeing, and I'd like you all, us all to sort of experience it at the same time now. Page 4 and page 22 are essentially two hierarchies. Authoritarian rule, first under Pharaoh, and then the people of Israel created for themselves. They go back and recreate what they had left. And at the back of the book, on page 93, it says that, you know, what is it that God demands? Hierarchical leadership, and the other image is a circle, with Christ in the middle. And the word all appears there as God's commitment is to all people, not just to those at the top of the pyramid or at least higher up in the pyramid. What I'd like to do is to just play with the word all for a little bit. We have an interesting book here just published by the ELCA. It's a study on economic life. Give us this day our daily bread, sufficient and sustainable livelihood for all. For all. And just pass that around and take a look at that. Can anybody, let me not skip to that just yet. From Paul's lessons, we are familiar with this phrase, one bread, one body, one Lord of all. Luther suggested that we needed to get the Bible into the hands of all people, average citizens, so we would translated into German, the language of the people, and because Luther believed that we were the priesthood of all believers. Can someone, without the flag being here, recite the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, with liberty and justice for all.
For
all.
Okay, let's take a look at this in some now democratic terms. What the hypothesis has been is that is it possible that Christianity is the forerunner of democracy? Is one of the hunches. And the other hunch I have is that if the church is to mature fully, must it do so? Let me put it in affirmative terms. I think that it will need to do so under democratic principles and practices. And what I'd like to do now is to take us on a brief history of the struggle for American democracy and essentially a debate between Jefferson and Madison that Jefferson lost. And we have a radically different democracy than what Jefferson hoped for. And although Jefferson was not a Christian, I understand that Jefferson was a Unitarian, he was nonetheless a person of faith and was interested in trying to bring, I think, principles of faith into our understanding of what does it mean to be a citizen. So just if it's not dark enough here, if somebody wants to flip on the right hand, the one on the right hand side, going thank you, and it might darken a little bit. A citizen is simply a member of the household. That's Independence Hall, by the way, in Philadelphia. But take a look at these words of Jefferson as a sort of preamble to our life together in a democracy. I think the first line is absolutely amazing, the first part of the first sentence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. That's really quite amazing, that there is really nothing that we can do to prove that all, Jefferson did mean men, and the ongoing redemption of democracy is part of our responsibility. Susan B. Anthony helped to redeem it so that we meant more than men. Dr. King redeemed our understanding of all so that it included people of color. We need to continue to redeem our understanding of what we mean by all, but the word all is in there. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I think that is a theological statement. And it is a theological statement upon which a nation's democracy is built. So let's just take a look at this word civility, because that's what we're encouraged to consider these days. There's a lot of talk about civility, but let me caution us about that, because civility, rightly understood, I'm all in favor of. Civility, as popularly understood, I'm leery of. This is the definition that I'm leery of. Civility that equals politeness. Politeness is not a bad thing. But this definition of civility suggests that it's a social virtue, sort of a conduct code, and it's how to behave when the king is nearby. Keep a civil tongue in your head. Whether it's the boss, or the pastor, or the head of a household, we can create environments where the opinions of all are not welcome. And this understanding of civility is how to keep your head while the king is in town. But an original definition of civility looked more like this. That civility had to do with being a responsible member of the household. If all were invited to participate, then what we're interested here is not a social virtue, but a civic virtue. That is, what is my public behavior going to be like as I act out my membership in a city? Remembering that democracy has a twofold promise of rights and responsibility. I'm fond of asking the question, raise your hand if you've seen the Bill of Rights or a facsimile thereof. Raise your hand if you've seen the Bill of Responsibilities. We didn't write one, but it was an assumed part of our life together. Because communities were smaller, we understood the obligations that we had to one another in community. And I believe that that understanding of life together in community is not that much different than what the people of Israel tried to learn in the wilderness school through an understanding of what Erlander calls the manna way. Living in ways that honored the Sabbath, that honored their lives together. It is not that different than I think the ideal community that Jefferson envisioned, where people would be practicing the principles of democracy together. Here's where the Jefferson-Madison debate begins. And this is not only two different views of human nature, I think it is two different theological views. Two views of American citizenship. Jefferson believed that citizens can formulate and enact the common good. And Madison believed that if men were angels, no government would be needed. So, based on that understanding of the human person, Jefferson argued that people can be taught civic virtue. And what he meant by that was even the farmers. That was the debate. The Shays Rebellion was going on in where I grew up in Massachusetts. Farmers were shooting each other, and those who were trying to impose the tenets of law and democracy And Madison looked at that and said, look, the causes of factioning are among us. It's always going to be there. They cannot be removed. They can only be controlled. We people cannot come together in community and to learn to live together, I would say, in love. Madison says that there will always be special interests, and we need to control them. We can't do more than that. Jefferson's view was that because he thought people could be taught how to live as democratic citizens, he said we should educate people into civic virtue. So Jefferson became a proponent of public education. And Madison said, the only thing we can do is balance the vices. At this point in the debate, Jefferson takes a post overseas as ambassador to France. And the debate continues without Jefferson. And the democracy that we have has a lot more to do with Madison's notion of balancing vices. Look at the distribution of powers, right? What are the three powers that we have?
Executive, legislative, and judicial.
Okay. And the separation of powers has everything to do with the belief that people cannot be trusted to live together in community.
But the federal system, that you're balanced by other centers of power against the central power, yeah.
Absolutely. And so let me just tell a quick story here about our education system and what our education system looks like and what it might have looked like had Jefferson stayed in town. My sense is if he stayed in town, he was such a powerful speaker and writer. My sense is that we might have had a different democracy. So here's a story about John Dewey. John Dewey is an American educator, prolific writer, and this is a story about Dewey was doing some tours of education programs going on in the States that he thought were innovative. He was especially interested in what he called experiential education. Don't do what I'm doing here, sort of stand up and talk to people, but let people experience things, and through experience, it would be the most profound way of understanding themselves in the world. So he had heard about a program that in Texas that was teaching young people how to swim on dry land. He said, that's amazing. He said, if we can teach young people how to swim on dry land, anything is possible. We'll be able to teach people how to fly planes without being in planes. We'll be able to teach people all kinds of things. So Dewey went to visit this program in Texas. And he spent some time talking to the teachers who were teaching this program. He spent some time talking to the faculty and the administration. And he was just amazed. He went out and he observed the young people. They were laying down on the outside lawn, and they were doing their leg kicks. And then they would stand up, and they would move their arms, and they'd do their head rotations, and they were teaching these kids how to swim on dry land. And he thought, this is amazing. Well, just before he was about to leave, he decided he was going to talk to a couple students. And he talked to this one student, and the conversation went something like this. He said, so how long have you been practicing swimming? And he said, well, about 3 weeks now. And he said, how's it going? Do you know the strokes? And the student said, yeah, I know how to turn my head and my arms and kick my legs. He said, it's great. And Dewey said, have you ever been to the water? And the student said, yes. And Dewey said, what happens? And the kid said, I sink. We take eight kids up to the time they're 17 or 18, and for the most part, we put them in autocratic settings. Somebody's up front, and they're not. Somebody is deciding the curriculum, and they're not. Somebody has decided the rules of the community, and they haven't. Somebody enforces the rules of the community, and they don't. And at the age of 18, we hope that by osmosis, they have learned everything they need to know about being a citizen in a democracy, and then we launch them off as citizens eligible to vote. My son, who is not in the village at the moment, for the last year and a half in our household, the most important thing in his life was getting his driver's license. I counted, and at one point, it was upwards of about 1,200 hours that he had put into thinking about getting a driver's license, studying to take the driver's license, doing behind-the-wheel tests, taking classes, preparing, reading the books. About 1,200 hours of family time and his time getting ready to prepare to learn how to drive. Now, we live in a household where we talk a lot about civic responsibilities, but my guess is that he spent about one-tenth of that amount of time understanding what it will mean to get his voter's registration card. I think that we live in a democracy that doesn't take democracy seriously. When asked in a sort of civic intelligence test, Americans who had their citizenship were given a test that immigrants who were trying to become citizens need to take, and most Americans did not pass it. But one of the most interesting answers to me was, what form of government do we live under? And about 30% of the respondents said capitalism. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, because we believe that in a foundational way that people were angels, we wouldn't need a government, and all we can do is balance vices, that we literally have not taken as seriously as we might what it means to educate people into civic virtue, into citizenship. Jefferson believed that if we trusted citizens, we would bring citizens together to directly, and important here, profoundly work out social problems. Madison believed that we ought to keep citizens apart. If you take a look at city halls in your community, I'd be surprised if there is a city hall anywhere in this country where more than 200 citizens from that community can gather. No matter how big the town is, no matter if it's over a million, I bet that the city hall, the place, the chamber where the city council meets, I would venture that none of them are bigger than 200, will house more than 200 citizens. Even the structures of our government don't allow for participation of all citizens. Last couple slides here. Jefferson believed in what he called the politics of engagement. He really believed that citizenship had to do with living together in community, and see whether or not these four words here in your mind create any images for you about Christian community. They sure do me. He said that if we were deeply engaged in each other's lives, rejoicing together and mourning together and laboring together and suffering together, like the people in Grand Forks, North Dakota, that then we would understand how to govern together. And as I listen to the words of Jesus, as I listen to the words of Paul, calling us together to be the body, it's that. And it's also Jefferson's belief that that's the setting in which democracy flourishes. Madison argued something that I find very startling. This is in a book by a guy named Daniel Kemmes, if you're interested in it, called The Good City and the Good Life. He says that essentially what Madison argued for was the politics of commerce. And what we needed was a constitutional framework for a commercially competitive society. And I've had a chance to revisit and take a look at our Constitution, and it has a lot to do with individual rights, but it also has a lot to do with freeing up the entrepreneur so that entrepreneurs, now in the form of corporations, can move easily across the landscape and do business not only nationally but globally. Madison, like Adam Smith, believed that the hidden hand would save us, that if we just set out to become this commercially competitive country, that the hidden hand, as we created wealth, we would create goodness, and this hidden hand that Adam Smith talked about would essentially save us, and we would not only have a wealthy society, but we'd have a good society. And all of us are familiar with hundreds of examples where, in recent years especially, we've created a lot of wealth and have not created much goodness. Jefferson didn't believe in the hidden hand. He thought it would take conscious responsibility of all citizens, actively participating as citizens and concerned about all, and actively living that out. So I'd like to end where sort of we began, Jefferson's notion. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among these being life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What I'd like to explore with the time that we have left are the two hunches that I have, that Christianity really does give birth to democracy. It prepares us to share power in ways that democracy is dependent upon. But that the church itself is the other hunch that I have. If it is going to continue to grow, we'll also need to do so based on democratic principles and practices. So let's talk about that and anything else you want to.
I like to say more good things about Madison, but that's another thing on that, and from a theological perspective. But here I just started with an idea. I think Roland Bainton, and I don't think it's original with him, to talk about, you know, that really what we understand as democracy of permitting groups to speak and to act and have their religious faith, just a religious expression of freedom there, and so maybe focus upon that, really came out of 17th and 18th century England, when you had all these competing groups under here, that mother voice, in order to have peace, you of necessity had to provide a framework for this to take place. And that sort of preceded here, you know, what happened in the United States. And so it was not the voice of enlightenment and of tolerance and of conversation, intellectual conversation here, but a kind of necessity in order to peace. And almost a Madisonian model here that, because you have these competing voices, democracy requires a framework in which those voices need to be protected. I'm right. I mean, we owe primarily to the mind of Madison the Bill of Rights, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to put it in that framework, I mean, why that the Bill of Rights takes these protections against power from above and power forces from within. And that idea that Christianity came struggling and screaming and here into freedom of religion. That you mentioned. And therefore, democracy in the larger sense of having the voice of everybody having the right to be heard.
Right. And I appreciate that, because it's my goal not to demonize Madison. I think he's an important voice in our country. But to set up this notion of the tension between, we had talked about Pharaoh's Egypt fell into an autocratic system of power. People of Israel live under Pharaoh, and they move into the Promised Land, and under Solomon they retreat right back to the hierarchy. And both Moses and Jesus call the people to a different type of community that is more egalitarian. And Jefferson, I believe, was prepared to give that a try. And Madison argues, you know, history suggests that you shouldn't give it a try. And I believe that you know, Jefferson is in the company of Moses and Jesus to say, let's give it a try.
Well, what about this pursuit of happiness, though? That doesn't really seem to have any relationship to Christianity. I mean, I don't think one of the goals of Christianity is the pursuit of happiness. I think there's some big differences between political structure and Christianity.
Originally said it was pursuit of pleasure, wasn't it?
Actually, John Locke.
John Locke. Okay, that was
the pursuit of property.
Well, property was not pleasure. Property.
And some people argue to this day that, you know, because we didn't take Locke fully, that you know, we have denied an essential element of human nature that desires to own and have and possess things. But I think that Jefferson was trying for a nobler ideal when he said, it's not property, it's happiness. And then the question is, we talked about this last week, what gives us happiness? And I would argue that a profound understanding of happiness is based in faith.
When I get very confused about the word democracy, just like I get very confused about the word capitalism, but even more democracy, for the following kind of reasons. One is that it's very difficult for me to separate the structure that we have embodied democracy in, especially a representative federal government right. system instead of a true democracy.
Right.
And then from some of the basic sort of values that are inherent in a democracy, which could in fact be inherent in other structures of government, mm-hmm. even a benevolent autocracy or oligarchy or, you know, multiple things like that. And one of my great frustrations when I look at this particular democracy's embodiment is that we have, we just passed a bill around welfare reform, and the criteria is A, what is possible, and B, the tyranny of the majority, in terms mm-hmm. of when we're talking about values and morals, mm-hmm. and so that you can have all of the basic democratic values, but they are not necessarily the Christian community's values. Mm-hmm. They can be around how decisions are made, but not necessarily what decisions are best for the community, and those are the ones that in fact we will go after. It's the very process of the political, as different even from the economic, which is a different problem.
And this is good. Let me just see if I can push this a little, and you know, for the sake of good discussion, could it be that we have the problems that we have with democracy because, you know, it is being confused with the market economy, and people see democracy as the main tool they have to make sure that they get their share of the pie. If I were to suggest that, what would happen if we were to begin to modify our school system so that young people began to not only hear about democracy and the founders of democracy, but began to be taught in democratic settings? What would a democratic classroom look like? And then if people had lived experience with democracy as a place where they could hear their own voices, and begin to not only recognize that, but to recognize that in a democracy, they also had responsibility for each other, including the minority, in any opinion. What would happen to our life together if we changed the way we educated young people? First of all, what do you think a democratic classroom would look like?
Yeah, my basic response was exactly the same. Yeah, it would be chaos.
Now that's very interesting. So why is that? Why is that?
Because there's not one leader telling you what to do.
Okay.
It's like the model of Jesus and the disciples. That it wasn't a democracy. There's a teacher, and there are people who have to learn.
How did they replace Judas?
I don't know if they did.
They voted.
Yeah, casting lots.
Casting lots.
But they also had criteria for who would be represented by the lots.
And they still had a leader who was Jesus. Really, the model is more like a monarchy, it seems to me.
Well, can you go back to what we read, though? Jesus said, who is more important, the person serving or the person at table? Well, the person at table. But then Jesus says, I am here as one who serves.
True, but then, you know, the first should be last and the last should be first. I mean, you don't have to look at it as a democracy. He certainly didn't endorse, you know, any political system. I think he was talking about the system that he was in.
I agree with that. I don't think he endorsed any political system.
Maybe but core values that we talked about last week.
But I wonder, and I want to push this, and feel free to push back. I'm wondering, however, if the belief that the people have gifts and we're capable of exercising those gifts on behalf of the community, if that belief isn't the forerunner of democracy. Let's go back to the other question just for a moment. What would a democratic classroom look like beyond chaos? Okay, let's just say, and I want to differ because I've actually run a democratic classroom. What else do you think?
At what age were you running a democratic classroom?
I have run a democratic classroom. I work who runs democratic classrooms for 5 through 18-year-olds.
But there is somebody establishing norms with that group.
Do you want to know who? Mm-hmm. The young people.
Okay. And how do they go about doing that? I mean, who taught them those skills?
The teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Democratically. Let me give you an example.
All right.
This might make sense. I was responsible for a group of young people, something called the Youth Conservation Corps. In Southern Oregon. This was a group of inner city kids from LA, sort of rough and tumble kids. And their job was to work 6 hours a day in a wildlife refuge and go through 2 hours of environmental education. And I knew the first day it was not going to be any trouble because these kids knew their way around the city, but they did not know their way around the wildlife refuge. They were absolutely intimidated by the open space. So they were ready. They were in a foreign enough environment that they were ready to
take some guidance.
Right. Anyway. I had responsibility for discipline, and we only had 3 rules in camp. No drugs, no alcohol, no cohabitation. Okay? And everything else we worked on democratically. It was a small group of 30 people. We set up a town hall meeting every evening for 5 minutes to an hour, depending on what the community needed to talk about. I set up a peer review committee, and what that meant, if anybody broke one of the 3 non-negotiables, as we called it, they went before the peer review committee. Long story short, 3 of our enrollees, as they were called by the federal government, were on campus one evening smoking marijuana. We lived on a college campus in Southern Oregon. I called together the peer review committee, and I said, well, we hoped that we wouldn't have to use this, but something has happened. Let me just remind you of the 3 rules. And your job is to do 2 things, determine whether or not there was actually an infraction, and then if there was, to determine a sanction. And I left the room. And there was a 13-year-old and 2 14-year-olds in the room. They asked the 3 people who had the infractions to come to the hallway, and they set it up so that young people, one at a time, who were thought to be the people who violated the rules, were asked to come into the room one at a time and left through another door. You know, they were smart. They said, we're not going to let them, you know, try to corroborate stories, you know. They understand. They're clever young people. So they put them in the hallway one at a time, brought them in. First question, I'm hearing this after the fact. No. Were you smoking dope on campus? The first person said yes. I said, okay, thank you for being honest. That person left. Second person, were you smoking dope on campus? Yes. That person left. We'll get back to you about sanction. Third person came in. Were you smoking dope on campus? Oh, no. Oh, no, no, not me. And they said, well, would you like to reconsider that? No, you know, no, I wasn't smoking dope. Okay. So they sat around and had time to decide, and they called the 3 people in and told them this. And then they held a community meeting based on their own judgment to tell the community what had happened. This is all being decided by 13 and 14-year-olds. Here's what they decided. The first 2 did violate a rule, but they told the truth. And since it was their first infraction, what they needed to do was to publicly apologize to the community and take some additional sort of cleanup duty. At the end of the day, we have clean tools and stuff, and they give them additional cleanup duty for a week. Third person, they said that because you lied, you have broken the trust of the community, and you can't stay here anymore. You have to go home. And they sent the person home to LA. But they said, because, if you're interested, 4 weeks from now when we graduate, you can come back and celebrate with us. You can't graduate, but you can come back and celebrate with us. And what they recommended is that the community go down to the train station with this person to say goodbye, because it's not that they didn't like this person, but that this person had violated community expectation. I wish I was that smart. And those young people did it for two reasons. Number one, they were trained. And number two, they were trusted. And there was no chaos in the room that I could tell. Kristen.
My experience underscores what you're saying. I used to work with teenagers that were in trouble, and they would come to this private school, and the most effective way of getting those kids to get their lives back together was to have them talk to each other, because they knew the games that kid played, because they played it themselves, and they also knew where their lives were headed. And they could trust each other's word more than an autocratic adult who was telling them, no, this and that. So they were supportive of each other. And I really strongly believe that kids are not acknowledged for their potential. Whether it's leadership or, that we assume that kids are kids and they're not people. So.
Yeah, I see here that and the wisdom of 13 and 14-year-olds is they intuitively understand that rules are for the sake of community. In our society, rules are handed down for somebody outside or above the system. And they're simply to be ruled because they are ruled,
right,
rather than rules that enable us to be together. And Erlander, of course, talks about that very perceptively.
Yeah, and if I could build on that for a second, then we'll come to yours. This friend of mine who's doing this for kindergarten on up, who's done it actually for 10 years, and at the center where I work, we're launching two projects. One is character education, a second one, democratic education, and we've identified six sites around the state that are embracing both character education and democratic education. Character education is sort of a disguised word for values education, because people don't want to talk about values in public schools. And our belief is that you have to talk about character education and democratic education simultaneously. We teach people about values, the values that it takes to live together in community, and then teach them the principles of democracy, the art of governing ourselves in community. This person, a colleague of mine who does this for elementary school kids, including kindergarten kids, simply begins with questions like this. Do you remember a time when someone was nice to you? What was that like? What was the person doing when they were nice to you? Do you remember a time when someone was being bad to you? What was that like? And what rules would you like for this classroom? Would you like people to be nice, or would you like people to be bad? And most kids vote that we like to create a climate, is what he calls it, where people treat each other nice. And so what would we be doing if we were treating each other nice is the question. And they come up, and it's whatever words they come up with are the words that go on the board. And then at the beginning of each day, because elementary kids don't have long memories, you go over the list of behaviors that they've described. And you say, before we begin our day together, we're just going to remind ourselves of the type of environment, the type of climate we want to live in today. And it's amazing to watch these 5- and 6-year-olds engage in self-sacrifice because they have created rules together. I've got one more story I want to tell you here.
One thing I think when I think of kids running themselves and having a lot of control in an inner community, I also think of street games. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a community. It's not really a democracy because you don't really vote, you know. Then it comes from the older kids down, but I just have trouble. I guess I'm having trouble because what I hear from my teacher friends from the city, this is in Chicago, and they teach at parochial school, is like, structure is very important to these kids because it makes up for what they lack at home, you know.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit.
You got like all these kids and they're single parent families or there's all this stuff chaos going on in the home life, and I just want to feel like it's addressed.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good question, and it, for me, it's an argument for democratic education, and let me describe it, why I mean that. We teach chemistry in high schools, and we teach people how to balance equations, and we introduce them to the periodic table. But we also believe that if you're going to understand chemistry, you need to have a chemistry lab and actually watch chemicals interact. But because we're smart educators, we make sure that there's teachers in the lab who are making sure that the chemicals that get mixed are the ones that should get mixed, and because we don't want schools to blow up. Well, democracy is sort of like a chemistry lab. It's a very, very delicate balance at times. And just like we have faculty and teachers in chemistry labs, we need teachers to be in democratic labs in the classroom. And there's a whole continuum of freedom that you can give the students, but my experience, especially with students who don't have much structure in their lives at home, what they resist is structure imposed from without. What they embrace is structure that they've helped to create.
Okay.
Here's a quick story, one last story about working with young kids. In this case, it involves a 3-year-old. A friend of mine is a clinical psychologist, and he has a couple of kids now, but this is when he only had a daughter who was 3. And he used to love on Saturday mornings to go with his daughter grocery shopping. And that was sort of their time together. So they'd leave the house early, they'd go out and have breakfast somewhere, and then they'd go grocery shopping. And the first time he went grocery shopping, he went grocery shopping with his daughter. He was going down the aisle and putting things in the cart, and his daughter was watching him and wanted to help. So she started going down the aisle and putting things in the cart. And he looked around and they had cat food and, you know, and they didn't have a cat. You know, so she was not being helpful, and his reaction was, she's just disturbing things here. And he would, you know, find this stuff and he had to go back down the aisle and put it away. And he was getting frustrated. He wanted to spend time with his daughter, but it wasn't going well. So he was driving home one day feeling frustrated, knowing that he and his daughter did not have a good morning together. And he thought to himself, okay, wait a minute. I'm a clinical psychologist. Let me give myself some advice here. You know, your daughter is not being a bad person. Your daughter just doesn't understand the rules of shopping. Right? And so the next Saturday, they got up a little earlier, and he said, I need your help. And she said, okay, Daddy. And he said, I need to make a list of the things that we need before we go shopping. Okay, he said, so what we do is we look at all the cupboards where we keep our favorite things. If we have it, it doesn't go on the list. If we don't have our favorite things, or if the favorite things we want, we don't have enough of, then we will get some more. So they went through the cupboards, they went through the fridge. And, you know, he could have made the list in about 10 minutes. It took him about an hour to make the list with his daughter. But they constructed a list together, and now she understood what shopping was for. So they went shopping. And all of a sudden, you know, they're going down the list. She goes, what's on the list, Dad? We need butter. You know where the butter is? You know, it's over there. And she knew what the butter looked like at home. So she'd go over and pick out the butter that they have at home and put it in the cart. And now he's got a helper. He was amazed that now everything that she was putting in the cart was a good contribution. And she was feeling good. He was feeling good. They were having a delightful day together. and they're going through the checkout stand, and there's that little section of things where you get, you know, they get you on the way out.
Yeah.
And on that rack was his daughter's favorite candy bar.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "You have been such a good helper today." He said, "I'd like to buy you this candy bar." And she looked at him and said, "Daddy, it's not on the list." If a three-year-old can engage in self-sacrifice because they were included in a democratic process, then who can? And my belief is that that's what Christian community is about. It is living in a community under the understanding that is that we will need to engage in voluntary shared sacrifice in order to ensure that the community is a place where the most vulnerable is protected, in order to ensure where all of God's people have their basic needs met. And I'm not sure yet, and you're helping me to look at it. And I wonder if that understanding couldn't be framed in a secular way and be a powerful philosophy upon which our democracy is built. And the other question we haven't explored, I don't know how we're doing for time, is that is it possible to govern the church without the use of democratic principle?
I really haven't. I've started thinking about what you've been talking about. I'm not a college professor, or I work for a nonprofit, I'm sort of a businessman. But what I learned about American history, I started in Virginia. And then England sent over all the people that they didn't want anymore, people out of prisons, and they gave land grants to members of the royal families, and they put these people to work, and they started producing tobacco, and it was addictive, and they sold it, and the king received a share. I don't remember how much it was, but it was like $500 million or something, and real money, big, mm-hmm. big money, big enough to fund an entire kingdom, England, and it was headed by the Church of England. And they would send over appointed church people to enforce the laws that were written in the and signed by the king. And they would get appointments, and of course they really couldn't tough it out, so they're constantly going back to England, and people would always die. And then as the economic structure developed, there was the up in New England where they didn't really grow things as well, so they started their own processing of the cotton and cloths, and then they passed laws saying they couldn't do that, and it was in that backdrop, and it was all done under this hierarchical Christian structure, and they had divorced themselves from the Catholic Church and decided that the King of England represented God or something. I'm not really a good historian, mm-hmm. But all that had much greater impact on us than some of this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll just drop it.
Well, it's a good point that, you know, one of the questions I'd like to ask is, can the church be the church in a hierarchical structure?
Well, I'll just take another bit about that history as I see that. But there's an errand in the wilderness that that came here from the dissenters in England who wanted to escape the authority of the church and of the government there, and came over here in the name of religious freedom, established another authoritarian system. And so you needed somebody like a Roger Williams and so forth, and an Anne Hutchinson, and these sort of stories here that we find here that. I mean, the beneficiaries of freedom are often tomorrow's, tyrants. I mean, Exhibit A for history is always the French Revolution. You know, it was founded by the new advocates of liberty, equality and fraternity are the ones that are tomorrow's tyrants. And so somehow the Jeffersonian hope and dream of participatory democracy must be balanced with something like Madison, I'm a student of Reinhold Niebuhr,
right.
And the sort of study, the kind of we have to listen to both the children of the light and the children of darkness, on here, and both to hear the Madisons and the Adams here that had that sort of sense that human beings, when they do their sorts of stuff, they will muck it up, and we have to live in a world in which there are checks, you know, as well, you know. And then you heard that you were saying that Jefferson has not really been given a try, particularly in the church.
that's the question I'd like to explore, is that has Jeffersonian democracy been given a chance in this country, and has democracy and an egalitarian form of governance such as Moses and Jesus, I believe,
or the New England town meeting, for secular example,
has it been tried in the church to govern ourselves with democratic principles, and has it been tried in our country?
Congregationalists tried it.
I'm not familiar with the Congregationalists.
I mean, that goes out of that tradition. I mean, they have put the religious version of the town meeting that each community sets the boundaries and the priorities and establish. And at least it's sort of the endeavor there that there's the participation of that. And so. Quakers, and their own way, have done that because listening to the, the power of the Spirit within the community, and the basic trade tradition doesn't even allow for, ministers of that, because all people, are available the inner light.
And so
we've had those movements that have seen that contrary to the structured hierarchical system.
But are those communities small enough to rejoice, mourn, labor, and suffer together? And our culture now, we're, bubbles, and we do that maybe within our family and not within a community.
Or a small intentional community.
Yeah,
but beyond that,
American culture.
Yeah, and it's, because you can do it in a congregation, you can do it in a sort of a very disciplined community that's self-disciplined, but can you move that beyond, setting?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting about democracy in the United States is that I think we can see in our culture that the individual is really glorified, or that the importance of the individual seems more important than the group many times, whereas in other cultures you see something different. Japan, for instance, where really I think the group is more important, and if you are looking at self-sacrifice, that's something to consider, whether democracy really was the ideal of Christ, and whether if he were here he would say, yes, this is my country, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure about that.
I think, on to something with our, our values of individualism here that are really run counter, I think, to your vision of Jeffersonian.
Mm-hmm.
Things, or even the the Quaker Fellowship, or the the gathered congregation.
So I wonder, if the church, this is again all half-baked ideas, because it's difficult to transform a federal system of representative democracy into something that might be more Jeffersonian. That would be a huge undertaking. Municipalities that are smaller could make some progress, but I wonder if the governance of churches doesn't provide us a more intimate opportunity to see whether or not the employment of democratic principles honors the notion of the Spirit gives gifts, many gifts, but one body. And so the way to make those gifts most available to the community is to set up a form of governance that is essentially egalitarian, and there not only allows but really requires all of the gifts to be shared in a setting that honors all, and not a setting that honors hierarchy. So I wonder, whether or not the church would flourish more in a democratic context, and I wonder if democracy would flourish more because we were practicing it in our churches.
One thing about the United States, which is when Christ always says, including all people, it's my understanding the United States is one of the most diverse countries on the planet, not the most, as far as the amount of people, the type of people, the ethnic groups. And, you know, the great thing about that, it also, we have issues you'll see in the city. I don't know, I mean, you guys are city dwellers. I come from Chicago. Chicago's got the most racially diverse city around. Everybody is fighting for their part of the action. And I look around this room, I said, yeah, I see it in Holden Village. I have a really hard time seeing it in Hyde Park, Chicago, which is just a community within the city, you know, surrounded by the wilderness of the slums. I have a hard time because you got so many in South North Dakota, there's not that many people. They're pretty much, a lot of them are the same backgrounds, a lot of them are the same part of the same part of Europe, a lot of, you know, they're all got the same similar type of jobs. And it's seems like, I wonder if there's a limit to the size of things, or a limit to the amount of diversity, that you need something in common to hold things together. And once you get into a city, you no longer can throw, always depend on Christianity to hold it together, because it isn't going to be all Christian.